Kerry, please come in.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Kenny, and I'm an alcoholic. I actually am a fisherman, but most of my fishing has been up. I'm from Seattle, Washington, by the way. Most of my fishing has been up in Seattle, and most of the operations that I'm involved with are in Alaska. And they don't have too many red snapper in Alaska, so I just wanted to let you know that I'm not even sure I'd know a red snapper if I saw one. So, but I have caught a lot of fish larger than 64 and a half pounds. I'm exceedingly happy to be here this morning. I'm incredibly grateful to the Serenity by the Sea conference for getting in touch with me, for asking me to come and be here, and for treating me so special, and for my wife Shannon came down with me, and she's a little choosy about the conferences that we come to. I get asked to speak here and there, and sometimes we'll do a little Tri-Cities deal or something. Not so much the OMAC Winter Roundup. No, Kenny, I'm busy. The dogs, we need, you know, I'll stay home for that. We went over to Honolulu, Hawaii this year. Oh, yeah, Kenny, I think I can make that one. Destin, Florida, she looks it up on the internet. No, I think I can get my mom to come take care of the dogs. I think we should be able to work that one out. So we've had a fantastic time. My wife Shannon's was raised in Los Angeles, and I've had her kind of sequestered up in Seattle for, we've been married 15 years, we've been together for 17 years, and all of them happy, and just we've had a really great relationship. But so it's nice. You got my wife out into the sunshine and the beautiful white beaches, and I thank you for that. I want to thank Chris for asking me to come and share here, especially, and particularly I want to thank my host Clint for being so kind and picking me up, and Clint's a seafarer as well. I did start out in the fishing business going to sea, so we had a lot in common immediately, and we've shared. And once in a while, you run across these people in AA that you just know that this will be a lifelong friend, and I know that's going to be the way it will be with Clint and his wife, Linda. And I got to know a little about his story, and it's really, I got to see him stand up here today. His daughters, two of his daughters are here today. For the talk and to see their father. And it's just so amazing how we bring families together here. And it just brought me to tears to see Clint up with his daughters. And I know how special that is. So it's great that you guys are here this morning. I want to get a couple of things kind of off my mind here first. And I want to be really clear that I've been the recipient of incredible kindness in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been the recipient of unbounding love. I'm a person that has seen so many incredible, if I was to make a top 10 list of all of the most loving and kind and considerate stories I've know of, they would all be stories from Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really amazing. And one of the things that's come to mind for me recently are just these things, this love and tolerance of others is our code. It's a line it's been hitting home with me a lot lately in Alcoholics Anonymous, how important it is when the new people come into the room that we realize this spiritual potential. And I guarantee you, I'll talk about this in a minute, but I'll guarantee you that when the day I got sober, there wasn't anybody thinking, I think we'll bring this guy down to Destin, Florida, and have him be our Sunday morning spiritual speaker. There's this piece that says, out of our big book, I brought my big book up with me this morning, and I always do that when I talk. And some of the things, you know, I may quote a couple things from the book, but I'm probably not going to, you can rest assured I'm not going to open my book and start reading the book to you this morning. But this idea that it says most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful. It means the more open-minded I become, the more useful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been really important to me. I bring my big book up, and there was actually a time in my sobriety when the message was, Kenny, we're going to a meeting and you're not to share. That we want you to sit and listen. We're going to go and you're not going to be you're not going to be talking today. And there's a reason for that. It's because my story in the beginning was what it was like story. And it would just never end. It would just, you know, it was these poor people, you know, that had to listen to that stuff I would just go on and on and on, and then I would be, well, then I got into treatment, and they're thinking, well, finally, my God, and then it would come, and then I drank the day I got out of treatment, and then I was back in, and I was worse than ever, and then I was in jail, and then I was in this institution, and there's just, but it never, and finally, as a result, in early sobriety, really, of, and I got to be a little bit careful after our speaker last night of choosing my words wisely, because I used to say, and I will continue to say this, it's really tongue in cheek, but you know, I fell into the loving arms of a group of men that hand carried me through this big book, and that is the truth of it. You know, I was a person that was not going to get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the nice thing is I have a part of my story today that's the what happened part, that I had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps having been hand-carried through this program by a group of men that read this book to me word for word. And they read every word out of this book to me, and everywhere where there was something that I didn't understand, we looked it up in the dictionary, and we read paragraph by paragraph, and it wasn't a study, it was a do. They shared their experiences with me, and I've always been so grateful for that I have that. I have this what happened part of my story, and this what it's like now. I've been sober since June the 8th of 1989. I had 24 years of sobriety in June. I've been married, as I told you, and with Shannon for 17 of those years. I have a daughter who's 21 years old that came to live with Shannon and I when she was 5. We raised her together. She's 21. She's never seen me take a drink. Some of the stories that I would tell you from her perspective, she's come and heard me share my story several times. And from her perspective, it's always this, yeah, Dad, I know, but it's like the story of the guy who tells his kids about how he walked uphill to school both ways in the snow and they could barely afford shoes. She's like, I know, Dad, drinking is, you know, too much, it's not good, and the drug's bad, and yeah, Dad, we know, but she doesn't really get it. She doesn't really get it because the person that she knows is a different man than the person that came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She knows it's true, but she just doesn't really understand how it could possibly be the same person. And she's been with me 21 of those 24 years, and she will tell you today that she's told me several times over the last few years that, Dad, you really are becoming a more calm person. You are calming down. And I'm a person that got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to find a way to calm down or else. And it might seem impossible for you to believe, but I had periods in early sobriety where I went 10 days without sleeping sober. That's what was going on in my mind when I got here. I would stay awake all night long and walk the streets and eat sugar. Probably part of that was you know, the quadruple lattes. Thank God they didn't have all these rock stars and all that stuff then. But and to this day, I never have drank one of those kind of energy drinks. But had I been early sobriety, I'm sure I'd have been all over those things by the case. So, I just feel compelled to share a few of those things with you about the kindness and the love that I received here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and how important that is, that when the new person comes in, that we realize that these people have had the crap kicked out of them, and it makes a difference in the way that we treat these people, and that I should reciprocate that kind of love to the new people that come into my life today. So I think I have been become a kinder and more gentle person the longer I've been sober. This kindness and love that I talk about, it didn't always feel like kindness and love to me. It felt like sometimes I was being attacked, or that this stuff was being forced down my throat. And one of my mentors would say, "Kenny, you know, you might not want to do these things." I didn't want to go to the stores that I shoplifted and pay the money back and make those amends. I didn't want to go to people that I owed thousands of dollars to and tell them, "Here I am," and come up with the money and give them that money. I didn't want to reveal everything in my fifth step in five
people in my life
and tell me from the beginning that, you know, I know that you've spent a lot of time writing this inventory, but I also know that there's a few things that you didn't put down. And I'm not going to leave you alone, but I'm going to leave you here with God so that you can write those things on a piece of paper, or take it to the grave list. And when we're all done here today, I'm going to ask you to read those things to me. There's a piece in the 10th step, the 10th step in the big book is so profound that it has this piece that says, you count the number of times they use the words intuition, intuitive thought, the inspiration. He even goes further and calls it the sixth sense. He calls it the vital sixth sense. Vital means life-giving. Either we find this or we drink. The doctor's opinion is really clear that unless we find the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks, we'll be restless, irritable, and discontent. That I need to find that ease and comfort in sobriety that I once found in the drink, or else I'll drink again. That comes through this inspiration, this God connection, they say in the big book, our more religious members call it God consciousness, this awareness of some presence larger than myself. And this, the vital sixth sense, the thing that I think about the mother. When the mother's at the sink and the kid walks behind the mother doesn't even see the kid, but the mother says, hey, hang on here, what's going on? And I had the fortune of, I'm so happy I got sober when I got sober, and I'm happy I got sober with the people I got sober with, because they had this awareness, there was that vital sixth sense, this understanding of, "Kenny, I know you're holding something back, and I'm going to leave the room for a while, and I'm going to let you sit here with God for about 20 minutes, and I'm going to come back, and we're going to read those things when we're done." And so I was able to do a fifth step with holding nothing. I didn't want to do that, but the message was that, "Kenny, this is going to be like a mother's kiss compared to what the booze and drugs are going to do to you." And I knew that was true. It wasn't always easy. It wasn't always easy to accept, but there was something I just inherently knew that it was, that this was the last stop in the road for me. So, I got I was raised in Seattle. I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I was raised in Seattle. I was raised in an alcoholic home. My stepfather, who I was raised with, died on the streets of Seattle, homeless. Was a terrible, terrible alcoholic and never got sober. And I saw him struggle through my entire youth. Saw him in delirium tremens. I saw the effects of alcohol. I saw him screaming out in terror. I saw him with violent shakes, those kinds of... my mom got sober. She's been sober now about 40 years. You know, I came from this home, and in early... I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. I started drinking much before that, but 12 was about the time, the first time that I ever remember where I intentionally went out to get my hands on as much booze as I possibly could. There were some, you know, there were some things going on in my life as a child. And I think one of the speakers said earlier that it doesn't really matter. This didn't make me an alcoholic. I shared a bedroom with my brother who is, you know, an amazing man, and he's not an alcoholic, and he slept in the same bedroom as I did when we were growing up. So this isn't what made me an alcoholic. And matter of fact, I sometimes think it's harder for other people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's important to recognize that sometimes, that it's harder when people... A couple of my favorite speakers are this way, and I've got a chance to watch a lot of men make their bed and walk again. I've had a chance to sponsor a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous.
They had everything at their disposal.
And they came from a good family. They had good mothers and fathers. And sometimes it's harder for them because I had the ability, I had something to blame all this stuff on. I didn't know that it didn't have anything to do with that until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But when you come from one of these other families, it can be really difficult because you're like, I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't think like this. Why am I like this? So it doesn't really matter where you come from. You know, this is just my story. And my house was the house where there was a big party. We actually moved to a new house so that my parents could be closer to their favorite bar. That's the truth of why we moved there. That was, or I don't know if that was why, but that was, they were definitely the most excited about that they could now just walk up the street to Don and Isla's, which was the local tavern, and they would stay there till the tavern closed about 2 o'clock in the morning, and then the party would come to our house, and it would be just this wild scene. The police would come. There was violence. I would wake up in the morning. We just moved to this new house. It was a brand new junior high school. I would wake up in the morning. I was still wet in my bed as a kid. I would be covered with urine. I didn't have any clean clothes. I didn't know about personal hygiene, so I didn't brush my teeth or comb my hair or take a shower. I just towel dried myself off the best I could. I picked through the clothes that were on the ground, tried to find the cleanest clothes, and I would go to school that way. To this new school, and I was considered a bit of a freak, and then I had this other deal that wasn't well appreciated, which was that I had this deal. I don't like the term drug of choice, because for me alcohol was the drug of no choice. I didn't matter. I had no choice over alcohol. It was rent money. If it was your rent money, if it was. It didn't matter. It was the drug of no choice for me. But if there was a drug of choice, I'd say that my first drug of choice was called lack of oxygen to the brain. And what that meant was that I would choke myself as a kid until I would find this euphoria, and I would let go just a second before I was going to pass out, and I would just be in this daze, and the old man could be yelling at me, and it just nothing mattered. So I was a stinky kind of urine-soaked kid with this long, greasy hair. And then I would choke myself and stagger around, and I'm glad you find this humorous. My popularity waned a little bit, you know, in junior high as a result of that. But, you know, this is what I did. You know, I got my hands on some booze. There was a hippie that lived next door. This was the early 1970s. And There was a hippie that lived next door to us, and he was a really good hippie. So he did the proper thing. He had it once a year. He'd mow his lawn, and my brother and I got to do that. It would be about 3 feet tall, and we'd go over and cut all his grass down, and then when we were done, you know, it was like a 2-day affair. When we were done, he would give us some money, and so we went over to him. We said, "Listen, we'd like you to consider, rather than giving us money, if you could buy us some alcohol." And being a good hippie in 1972, he thought, you know, he was more than happy to buy alcohol for 12-year-olds. So he said, "Yeah, sure, but what kind of alcohol do you want?" Well, at my house, there was always a gallon jug of Gallo wine on the table, and there was plenty more where that came from. There was always, that was just the staple. There was a gallon jug of this Gallo wine. So I said, "Well, we'd like wine." And he said, "Well, what kind of wine do you want?" And I said, "I just kind of, you know, I think I already had that peculiar mental twist going, because my answer to him was, I kind of thought, what do you mean, what kind?" I said, "We're concerned with volume. You know, we want as much wine as you can get with the amount of money that you have." So he did the right thing, and he said, "Okay, I got you. I know where you guys are coming from." And he left, and he came back, and he had two grocery sacks, and in those sacks were 5/5, which are the big bottles, of MD 2020. So I like to tell that story just for that reaction right there, because I could end the story. I think I could end the story right there and be just fine. But you know, I this started a pattern in my life, and I drank that. I got my hands on that alcohol. I drank it as fast as I could. I drank as much as I could. Even the other young kids that we'd invited down to the schoolyard to drink this wine with us were saying, "Hey, I think there's something wrong here. You should not drink this much, this much." They had no idea, but they just knew inherently there was something wrong with Kenny's drinking. And I was this real introverted kid because of all these things that were going on. I didn't talk to anybody. I was frightened to death. But once I had that wine in me, and that was something that went well into my drinking, was I always knew if I drank a bottle of cheap wine down really fast, I would get that warm feeling,
able to catch my breath.
That day there was a gal at the school that I kind of liked, and she was cutting through the schoolyard that night on her way home, and I just ran down this hill and professed my love to her, tackled her to the ground, and tried to force her to give me a kiss, and that was as good as my drinking ever got. That's the truth. I mean, I always drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. Years later, you know, and things progressed for me very, very quickly. I ended up, our home was a broken home. I ended up in foster homes and group homes and institutions. I turned to a life of crime to support a drug habit, and ended up arrested and in jail, and never made it to high school. There were a couple of things along the way. John mentioned I was a fisherman, and that's, you know, I took a job as a fisherman when I was 17 years old. I made my first trip to Alaska, and I got on a fishing boat, and I just loved these guys. You know, they were incredible people, and it was the first time in my life I'd been around real men who worked hard, and they took me under their wing, and they taught me how to work, and they taught me some skills, and I really excelled. And in those days, it was really the wild, wild west in Alaska. Today I'm still in that business, and I manage a fleet of vessels, and we've got a couple hundred guys working for us, and you know, it's really but it's a whole different fishery now. Every boat, before you go out, the Coast Guard comes down and does an inspection. You have to have certificates that show that everybody on the boat's passed the drug test. It's a whole different deal. But there was none of that shenanigans when I was So everybody on the boat was drinking and doing drugs, and we didn't like work hard and play hard. We played hard while we were working and doing dangerous work completely out of our minds. And the guys that I worked with on the boat were doing the same thing, but they knew that there was an intensity to Kenny's drinking that bothered them, and it scared them. And those guys put me through treatment twice, paid for my treatment, and put me through treatment twice before they fired me. And the last 3 years of my drinking, it was that, I'm so enamored and in love with Bill Wilson and his story and his writing abilities. And when I was taken through the book and I looked at Bill's story, and he said, "I'd written lots of sweet promises. This time I meant my wife happily observed that this time I meant business." That means his wife, this person who was probably his greatest doubter at that time. But this time she realized something was different about Bill. He really meant it this time. There was some kind of a shift or a change in Bill that he meant. And then he writes that heartbreaking line that shortly thereafter I came home drunk. And I knew what that meant. I knew what that meant. I knew that what he meant by it. Then he went back, and that was his self-will. And then he said, okay, well, he went back, and he learned all about this. He said, certainly this was the answer, self-knowledge. And I'd been there. I'd been to the treatment centers and learned all about alcoholism and knew all kinds of things and had all kinds of intellectual concepts, and I knew everything. And then he says, he was off. How could this have happened? And he's off drinking again. And then his last deal that he tried was the fear sobered me for a bit. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear trembled, sobered me for a bit. And I understood that. But I came to understand that self-will and self-knowledge and fear will never keep me sober. I knew that. I tried all those things. The fear that, God, I don't want to go through that deal of... Before I got sober, I was 28 years old. I was living in the back of my mother's house, and I had overdosed in her bathroom and tore the shower curtains and everything off the wall. I was yellow. I was jaundiced. These guys had beat me up in a bar, and I had surgery on my left eye. I was just a total wreck, and I can tell you that story. But then I can think about, that mind of the alcoholic, that at some time I won't be able to recall that. And if I do, it's going to be vague, as if it happened to somebody else. And the thing that I will recall is that when I drink a bottle of wine down real fast, whew, I'll remember that. It's the mind of the alcoholic. And that there was an answer for that. There was a solution. The last few days of my drinking, I'd lost. There's a part in the big book. I'd lost everything worth. If we have this obsession that drives us, and that's the way it was for me. I had an obsession that I would somehow be able to put the right combination in. If I got the right combination of the right drugs and the right amount of booze, and everything was just right, just for a minute, I would be able to take one deep breath, and from there, I was going to be able to get sober. I just thought if I could just get to that spot for a minute, I'll be able to stop. And that type of obsession, I lost all things worthwhile in life. I was ended up behind. There was a McDonald's down in Seattle, and next door to the McDonald's was a little store and a couple of things, and they had a. There was a place called the Baranoff Tavern, which is still there. The McDonald's just recently was tore down, and the Baranoff Tavern was there. And the Baranoff Tavern is a Viking bar in Seattle, which means that's where all the Norwegian fishermen go to drink. So I kind of knew the area a little bit. And The McDonald's, if you walk by the front, it was a facade, but if you walked around behind, there was a space about 6 feet between those two buildings with some bushes, and I'd crawled back in there. I'd built a little cardboard lean-to so people, even if they got back in there, they couldn't see exactly what was going on. And I would hear these, I could hear the people through the drive-thru, and it was a real kind of a nerve-wracking way to live, because I could hear all this noise of the world going on from in my little box, and I would hear people come in and say, yeah, I'd like number 3 supersize with the Diet Coke, and I thought they were saying, somebody call the FBI, there's a freak back here shooting coke. So it was really a nerve-wracking way to live. And but you know, Bill Wilson writes about those final days of drinking. And we're so lucky to have this rich literature here in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I was taken through the steps, a really wise man suggested that he wanted me to go back and read the big book, but he wanted me to read it like I was reading poetry. He wanted me to, he said, you got to find a way to spiritually blow through that. People say read the black and white. He wanted me to spiritually blow through that. What is the essence of what's being said here? And we're so fortunate that we had Bill Wilson holding the pen and somebody that was so eloquent. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that I've had deep and effective spiritual experiences that have revolutionized my entire attitude and outlook upon life. The person that wrote the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the guy that wrote the Four Horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. But in the final moment, this person who was so eloquent wrote the way it was for me at the end and behind that McDonald's, and Bill's holding the pen and he writes, no words can tell. Somehow I had a friend that was going to an AA hall. Out in back of this McDonald's was a strip mall. And out behind there, it was kind of a horseshoe-shaped parking lot behind. And there were some decks. And one of these was an AA hall in Seattle called Fremont Fellowship. I could see the people out on the back deck sometimes laughing and having a good time. And this friend of mine who I'd actually, that neighborhood where I lived, his family actually took me in for a year. I lived with his family. They saw there was trouble in my home and they took me in. So they were like family to me. And he was going to AA meetings at that hall. So I thought, well, if I could just get out from behind here and if I can get into that meeting, my friend Don's going to give me a place to stay for the night. That was the best hope that I had when I came to you. Was that somebody would let me stay in their house and that he would nurse me back to health, which he'd done several times. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on a Thursday night on June the 8th of 1989. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. I don't know what kind of spiritual help I received that allowed me to get out from behind that McDonald's and walk around the corner and walk in the front door of that hall, but I did. I was emaciated. I was filthy, dirty. I had 0 minutes of sobriety. I had no shoes on my feet. I had a pair of jeans that were filthy. My shoes were in a bag that I was carrying in my hand because my feet had abscessed and I couldn't get my shoes on anymore because my feet were sore. And I sat through the meeting. My friend didn't show up. I don't know if I thought he lived there at the hall or what, but he wasn't at the meeting. And something happened to me that I didn't expect. And the meeting started wrapping up, and I was sitting in my chair, and I just started crying in this AA meeting. big alligator tears. And I think back and I just think like, you know, it just, when I think about that, when I cry now, you know, there's something attached to it. And then I knew I was crying, but it was empty, just hollow. I could have been sitting there not crying. I could have been laughing. It didn't matter. There was nothing left. You know, it was just totally empty, and these tears were streaming down my cheeks. And I like to say that I learned about giving from experts in Alcoholics Anonymous. A man who was to become my sponsor came up to me after the meeting. He was the secretary of the meeting that night. Came up after the meeting and said, hey, my friends and I have been talking. And if you'd be willing to go to detox, we'd be happy to give you a ride down there. As a matter of fact, he said, we've already made a few phone calls and they got a bed for you. So I thought, well, how in the hell do these guys know that I need to go to detox? I mean, I hadn't. And then I thought, well, you know, I got kind of a busy social calendar, and you know, how long is this going to take? And but I knew the answer. You know, it was yeah, I'll go. It was no big deal. And that intuitive thought, that inspiration, they didn't take me to Seattle detox. They took me up to Everett, which is one city just north of Seattle, not very far. But it was this divinely inspired deal that they took me there, because if I think they'd have taken me to downtown, I would have just maybe walked out the door. But once I was up in Everett and they got my clothes away from me and I was in my pajamas, you know, thoughts of suicide were running through my head, and I thought, well, I'll just hang myself here in this detox. And I couldn't find anywhere to attach a sheet because they designed these rooms for people like me. And just the idea of trying to argue with these people to get my clothes back, I just didn't have any game left. To argue with them, to give me my clothes back, and have to go through the guy, and then he's going to bring in second base and third base, and the guys are going to try to convince me to stay. And I knew the whole deal, what an effort it was going to take just to get my clothes back, and then I was going to have to try to figure out how I was going to get bus money. I didn't even know how to catch a bus from Everett to Seattle, but how I was going to try to get bus money, hustle that up to try to get to Seattle, to try to con somebody, and try to, what kind of a pack of lies am I going to have to come up with to get somebody to help me to get well. And I just didn't have it in me. So I got my first 5 days of sobriety at the Evergreen Manor Detox in Everett, Washington. Al, the guy that took me there that night, picked me up after 5 days, and he owned a little car lot down on Highway 99 in Seattle. And this was a little dirt lot, you know, maybe had a dozen cars for sale. And there was a little apartment that he'd fixed up in the back, and he let me stay there in that apartment. And every day he would come by, and for every day for 6 months, Al would come 7 days a week. Before I ever remember missing a day, Al would come and knock on the window and wake me up, and he would take me up to Jack in the Box and buy me a breakfast Jack and a cup of coffee and talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Al was the first man I ever prayed with in my entire life. I was 28 when I came to AA. I started in on this path of working the steps. There was a group of people, and there was a group of people that were working out of the Big Book. They found me hanging out at Fremont Hall. They would do what's called troll in the bottom. They would come by, they would look for the face of hopelessness, and there they found me, and they, you know, told me that this guy Frank, he called it special education AA. And what that meant was that a guy like me wasn't going to get the solution hanging out in the meetings. And there was a difference between being, if you want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a great thing. There's only one requirement. And I tend to like the short version of the third tradition. The only requirement is the desire to stop drinking. But if you want recovery from alcoholism, you're going to have to get to work, and there's some things you got to do. There's a difference between being in the meeting and in the solution. If you think you're in the solution because you're in the meeting, you're not. That was a great message for me. It was a huge gift, and these guys were going to be doing this deal. They had a there was a guy that was one day sober longer than I was. I was one day sober longer than Patrick. And Al was his sponsor as well. And Patrick actually started going down to this workshop. And I thought, well, you know, I got to get down there. You know, I'm one day sober longer than him, and he's kind of relying on me quite a bit here to, I better get down there and make sure they're doing it right. And I'd been to treatment quite a few times, so. So I started going down to the workshop, and you know, some really miraculous things started happening in that workshop. You know, I started reading the book from this place that I talked about. I started realizing that this book was meant for people that couldn't stop drinking, that had no answer, people that were this chronic type, this hopeless type, this type whom all other methods had failed. And there was something there for me. And besides, the people that were doing the workshop, they were so full of life and so happy. And there was just, you know, there was just this camaraderie. And I just really felt at home with these guys. We got close to being able we got up to the third step prayer. And there was a guy coming to town that was doing a little retreat up in the mountains. He was a guy from California. Everybody thought, well, geez, let's go up to this retreat, the whole workshop, go up to the retreat. And when we're up there, we'll do our third step prayer together as a group at this retreat. And Patrick and I thought, Patrick had called a couple nights. He called down to the car lot. He was staying in a little boarding room right up the street, had a little basement room in a house. I always had a little game. I could always get find some place to stay, or some girl that would let me stay at their house, or some person. You know, I was really homeless just for a few minutes at the end. But Patrick was a guy that was right off the skids and had been for a long time. And he had this little room, and he'd called me one night and said, hey, you know, after we were talking about God and the third step, he said, I had this wild experience. I was laying on my bed, and I felt like all of this energy just was coming out of my body, and I just felt like I was completely purged of all this stuff, and I just, you know, felt totally light. And I thought, well, Patrick, you know, that sounds a little funny to me. You know, something must be going on here. And we got to talking, and we decided that, I said, well, Patrick, did you drink the coffee at the workshop? And he said, well, yeah, I did drink the coffee. And I said, well, Patrick, I didn't drink the coffee, and I didn't have any such experience. And so clearly what we have on our hands, we have this group. It's a cult that exists, must be a cult that exists within Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're going down there, and these guys are putting drugs in the coffee. And, you know, eventually they're going to be after all our worldly possessions. And yeah, Patrick's at the boarding house, and I'm at my sponsor's car lot. But you know, the amazing thing about that is there is some tongue in cheek about that, but that's a true story, and I honestly believed with every fiber of my being that this might be what I'd gotten involved with. You know, I was completely out of my mind. And I would go to the workshop, and there's still people sober around Seattle today that remember what I was doing. So we decided we would go up to this deal. We had a car that I'd bought from my sponsor off the car lot. He got my first sober job, my first sober car. I was still living at the car lot when I had my first AA birthday, 1 year sober. I was still living at the car lot. And I came home from a meeting. I told my sponsor, well, what are we going to do? You know, come on, Al, it's 1 year sober. And he says, no, as I recall, it was an 8 o'clock meeting that you walked into, and it's not 8 o'clock yet, so you better get up to the 8 o'clock meeting if you want to get a year. And I was really upset that this guy hadn't, you know, made some big celebration. I'm 1 year sober. And I went to the 8 o'clock meeting. I came back from the car lot, came back to the car lot, which was closed down. Everybody had gone home for the night. Came down to the car lot. I walked in, and there was a birthday cake. Al and I, you know, we had such amazing experiences, and he's still sober today. He's just, you know, he's one of these guys. He was in the hospital, and that's one of the things that happens if you stay sober long enough. Your mentors and your sponsors will get old and have problems, and I've had some really great experiences with him, and he was in the hospital. He'd had some heart problems. He was in Alaska, so he only made it to Anchorage. And they said, well, geez, we can't fly this guy to Seattle. We're going to have to do open heart surgery right here on the spot. And they did a surgery in Anchorage. And I happen to know a lot of AA people up in Anchorage. And so I thought, well, this is perfect. This is my chance to kind of give back to Al. I'll call all these AA people down there, and I'll tell them go up there and have a meeting for Al and his deal. And I called Al up and I said, Al, this is great. I'm going to have all these people come up to your room and help you out, and they're going to have a meeting. And Al says, Kenny, you still don't know me very well, do you? And he says, you know, I got a big stack of AA literature sitting here on my desk, on my table next to me, and my phone's ringing off the hook. He said, I'm doing really well. But if you know somebody that needs some help, if you'd send them up here, I'll wrap them up. Isn't that nice? And those are the kind of people I've been exposed to around Alcoholics Anonymous, or people that have that kind of attitude. But anyways, I got a car off the car lot from Al. He sold me this car. It was a $100 car. And this was a $100 tax, license included, tabs, everything, out the door down the street for $100. And it had this transmission fluid leak, which if you parked it just wrong on a hill, it would have this huge lake of red fluid that ran out, and the tires were totally bald. And so we're going to go up to this retreat up in the mountains, and we have to go up over Snoqualmie Pass coming out of Seattle. And we're looking at this car, and we're thinking, gosh, you know, I don't know, Patrick. You know, we weren't going to get it. We had plenty of offers for rides, but when you're in that kind of state of mind, you need a getaway vehicle. And so we were not going up there without a car. So he said, you know what? When I was at the very end, he said, I was living in my car behind this tavern, and these guys had broke my windows out, so I put up plastic, and then I had to sell my tires and wheels. But he said, I think the car ended up over at my sister's house. And it did run. He said, I think it had a little problem with a heating water pump or something. So we went, drove my car over there. Here's this car in the grass and the weeds. And we're thinking, well, it's definitely a way better option than the car that we drove there in. So we got this thing fixed up. We got tires and wheels and a battery, and we put a new water pump in it, and off we went in Patrick's car. And there was a little overheating problem going on, and we'd drive a couple miles, and we'd have to pull over, we'd have to wait for the thermometer to come back down. And other people from Seattle were heading up to this big retreat, and they saw us on the side of the road. They'd pull over and they'd say, hey, what are you guys doing? You guys all right? We'd say, oh yeah, we're just kind of chilling here for a little while and taking it easy. We'll be up there. We'll see you guys up there. We're doing just fine. And then they look and they saw all these huge jugs of water in the back seat. Well, what's with all the water, dude? You guys sure you're all right? No, we're fine. Yeah, we got a little left. We just kept going a couple miles. And then we thought, you know, maybe there's something to this prayer thing, Patrick. Maybe you and I should just say a little prayer together. We said a little prayer, God. You know, we're just a couple drunks. We're trying to get up here, do our third step. Just a little deal. And we go going, and we look on the side of the road, and there's this bus that's broke down, a big yellow bus, and the hood's up on the bus, and all the people are out. And there it says on the side of the bus, the Church of God on the side of this bus. And I just looked at Patrick, and I said, Patrick, if he ain't getting them up the mountains, we gotta, because that's not just That's not just any church. I mean, I'm not sure where everything falls, but that is the church of God. I mean, that's got to be pretty high up there. But we made it up to the retreat, and we did our third step, and I did my first inventory, and you know, it's again, when I was in the inventory process, I did inventory with a guy that was the facilitator of that workshop. I'd asked him to come sit in on my inventory, and he said, "Listen, I'm a busy guy, and I don't have time to mess around with you." I think he used a different kind of expletive, but you know, he said, "Here's a day that I have. I'll come down to the car lot on this day, and we'll go in the back in your little room there, and we'll do your inventory." But he said, "If you're not done with your inventory when I show up, I'm going to leave, and I'm never coming back." So you got that clear. And the day, that night before, I was writing inventory, and I was thinking, that guy, these people in the workshop hadn't really been treating me all that right. You know, every time I would start expounding on, you know, all this experience I had in AA, they continued to kind of bring it around to this deal that kind of irked me, that's great, Kenny, but what happened next? And it was always, I drank again. And that kind of bothered me that they keep pointing that out. But but I was just thinking, you know, when he comes and listens to my inventory and hears what everybody has done to me my whole life, he's going to be so sad that he treated me this way in the workshop in front of everybody. And then I had this other thought, which is that when he shows up, I'm going to be so stinking drunk. And there was a little AM, PM, little mini mart deal up the street from the car lot. And I think I'm going to go up there and buy one of those cheap bottles of wine. I'm going to drink that thing down real fast. And then when he comes, I'm just going to tell him what I think of him and his workshop. And I just went back and forth, but I ended up finishing the inventory. And he showed up, and he's one of these guys who was awake. And we got to reading the inventory, and he pointed out that, "Kenny, we're not going to be able to fix this here. If you think that this is about fixing all of your life's problems, you've come to the wrong guy. This is about asking God to remove this stuff and for you to get a brand new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. 20 years in the psychiatrist's couch can't fix this, Kenny. There was just, you know, incredible amount of damage and relationships and dishonesty and abuse and you just, you know, it was just this deal. And we started out with resentment, and I had my, you know, perhaps one of my largest resentments on there. And but it was a real simple piece of inventory for people that have written inventory out of the book. You know, it's these columns. Here's first column is the person, second column, why we're angry. It was a real easy piece of inventory because it was my mom. It had an easy first column. Second column was super simple. She ruined my life. Just didn't really have to go into that too much. And he started, you know, he started being able to ask the right questions, and he asked just intuitively. He would just get quiet, and then he would say, "Kenny, how old was your mom when you were born?" And he didn't know, but I knew. My mom was 19 when I was born. And I have a brother that's 18 months older than I am. So she was 19, a teenage mother with two young boys. I said, "Well, Kenny, was it all bad?" And I thought, well, I had to give him that. No, it wasn't all bad. It was just mostly bad, but it wasn't all bad. "Well, did you have a Christmas tree at Christmas?" And I thought, "We had a Christmas tree at Christmas, yeah." "Well, who do you think did that for you boys?" And I thought about my mom, and he said, "Was there food?" And I said, "Well, yeah, we were slim on food, and we really were poor. But we had, yeah, it was, you know, corn flakes, and wasn't frosted flakes like I wanted, but yeah, we had food." "Well, who do you think did that?" "My mom is doesn't play much anymore, but she was a musician, and she played guitar. She would go to the university district where the University of Washington is in Seattle, where we lived, and she would play guitar in the coffee shops when I was a kid on the weekends to make extra money for us kids. And then I remembered that at night, my mom would come into our room, and I don't ever remember her missing this. My mom would come in and sit down on the floor of my brother and I's room with her guitar and sit there and sing songs to us and play her guitar until we fell asleep. That's a pretty loving thing. The answer, my friend, is Whistling in the Wind, Joan Armatrading, and she would, you know, this is, as we started looking at this stuff, when I was institutionalized, my mom was a very moral person, still is. She always taught us, you know, do not steal, don't lie, you know, the golden rule, treat your neighbor. She was a very loving person. You got to love your neighbor, do unto others. It's, you know, all of those things were things that we were brought up with. Even though there was a lot of chaos, there were these core values that she just wouldn't compromise. But my brother and I got to doing some things and ended up institutionalized. I was in this work camp down in an area called Nacelle, Washington, which is about as far from Seattle as you can get and still be in Washington State. Probably 3.5-hour drive to get down there. And she would work all week, and she would come and see me on Saturday. And I remember, you know, that was the only hope I had, was that my mom, nobody else was coming to see me, was that my mom would come and visit. And my mom came, and she'd spend Saturday night there. And she would spend the night in that little town so that she could come and do another hour on Sunday morning. My wife Shannon calls her Mother Earth. She's a big woman. She has long gray hair and wears, you know, big dresses. We finally, a few years ago, had to talk her into selling her Volkswagen pop-up camper van because she kept going on these excursions, and then she'd call us from like the middle of New Mexico or the mountains of Colorado or something, and she'd be broke down. And we finally said, "Mom, you got to have something more reliable than this." But it was heartbreaking because that was her freedom. I mean, that was the place where she came from. And my wife and I moved into a new home not too many years ago, and it's really a spectacular place. And we had my mom come, and she wanted to do the blessing for the house. And you know, it was I was 5 years sober before I had a conversation with my mom where she didn't ask me if I was still sober. She didn't always ask the direct question, but that's what was going on. That's what, you know, we alcoholics, and I know there's Al-Anons here, and there's, you know, I don't want to say anything too controversial, but we alcoholics make other people sick. I know. I've had to make some amends in my life. I know what I did to some other people. My mom, I would call, and she would say, it would always be something different. For a while, it was just, "Are you still sober? What's your birthday?" You know, all those kind of things. And then eventually, it got to be, "Have you seen Al around?" Which was another way of saying, "Are you still sober? Are you still seeing Al?" "Do you still like to go to that meeting up at the hall? Do you still see this guy or that guy that you introduced me to?" But it was 5 years. I was 5 years sober when my mom, I had a conversation with my mom, the first one I ever remember where I was able to hang up and I think, "My God, she knows I'm okay." She didn't ask if I was sober. We just had a conversation. But my mom came to our house and we did this. And we had a drumming circle and we went around the property and she brought cornmeal from this shaman in Colorado. I swear to you. And she sang and we sang and the kids sang. And my friend Mike L. from Indianapolis was at my house at the time. So he got involved and was singing and doing the deal. And she hung a piece of red cloth that had to be in one direction, and she had five crystals that had to be placed around. I mean, she wasn't going to miss anything, and all because she wants to know that her boy's going to be okay and that he's going to be living in a safe house. So the truth is that I grew up in the presence of great love. And that was such an amazing discovery that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. And I used to have this friend Steve when I said I was only homeless for a few minutes at the end, but I was homeless several times as a teenager. And I remember I would be kind of wandering the streets, and I had this friend Steve, and he had this great garage. And so I would go over to Steve's garage. And it was just the coolest thing. He had huge, big speakers, which were the thing back then. And we'd be playing Pink Floyd. And he'd have all kinds of mind-altering substances. And he had you know, girls. And he had a cool dog that was just meaner than hell. And, you know, it was such a sweet, amazing place. And but his parents just let him live in this garage next to their house, so he could like go in and get food and stuff and come back out. And I just thought, man, if I could, when I was a young kid and I'd be wandering around homeless and then again as an adult for a little while, I'd see these clearly underutilized garages. And I would think to myself, my God, how great would that be to have a garage like that? I mean, Steve's place was so amazing. He had a bong that was so big, I'd have to ask Paul down there to light that thing up for you. You know, I mean, but the point of this, the point of the whole thing is that, you know, I used to think about that and see these underutilized places, and I'd think, God, I'd put up some blankets here, and I'd put a little bed in there, and I'd run some water in, you know, from a hose somewhere. I'd have a little light in there, and I'd hook up, you know, some music, and people could come over, and you know, that was the thought was, if only somebody else would let me live in their garage, life would be great. And just a few years ago, I was thinking about that story, and it occurred to me that I never saw the house. I never saw that there was a family, that there was bedrooms and kitchens and all of those things. I always, you know, and you don't know what you don't know, and you don't see what you don't see, and I never saw the house. I thought the best thing for Kenny, and through some reason, you know, it's amazing what happens when this obsession to drink, this merciless obsession that Bill talks about, is removed, the kind of people that we end up with in AA, because I never would have guessed in a million years, but as I've progressed, I just ended up being kind of sufficient in business and figuring things out and learning how to cooperate. And a lot of it was stuff I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been in negotiations where I've used things and told them, listen, you know, this is about the unity of the group, and we need to hang together, or we're going to die separately, and that we need to vote and have substantial unanimity. We don't want people going home being upset on the way that our organization is put together. And people are just, God, where did this guy, you know, what business school did this guy go to? But we've had some success. We live in a really beautiful home in Seattle and have a nice view. And this friend of mine that's heard me tell that story came over. He lived just down the street, a guy that I sponsor. And he came over to see the new place. He was the first one, first AA that came over to see our house, and he came to see the water, and he just looks at me and he says, "Hey, nice garage." So I get to play around with those kind of things today, that I get to ask myself, what is the garage in my life today? And Shannon and I say that all the time. We get to these things where we know this is good, and we think, but maybe this is just the garage, Kenny. You know, maybe we need to think about doing something. Maybe we can do something more for somebody else, or maybe we can expand on our life. And I'll tell this one story, and I got just a couple minutes left here. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was as hopeless a drunk, I think, as any of the guys I've ever worked with. And I just was convinced that, I knew I was an alcoholic. Yeah, I knew, but I just thought, what else is wrong with me? It was going to take something more profound. And I'd heard about these things. I'd watched late night television in the motel rooms, and I thought, well, maybe it's going to be, I'm going to have to go to one of these guys. It's some kind of a demon or something, and maybe that I'm going to have to get the hands laid on me. That someone's going to have to lay some hands on me. And I thought, well, maybe if they just got me and they just took the heel of their hand and they just jammed it into my forehead and said, demon of alcohol, be gone. And then I would drop and I would flop around and I would come to, and that obsession would be gone. I really believed that. I thought maybe that there's somebody that could do that. And I went to a couple of these kind of things. And the problem was always that after everybody left and I was by myself, the obsession would return. And then I thought, I'd heard about these people like my mother that would go to the guru, and they would spend time with the guru, and the guru would whisper in their ear some mantra that was meant only for them. That they would have this mantra, and that in times of difficulty and trouble, they could stop and say the mantra and repeat that to themselves, and all would be well. Well, maybe I need to go to the guru, and the guru can whisper this mantra in my ear. And the nice thing about that, is that one of the things I've learned in AA is the I am. I can't say the I am for Ralph as much as I've come to love him over this weekend. I can say Ralph is a loving child of God, but only Ralph can say I am Ralph, and I'm a loving child of God. That I have, that when my Creator speaks to me, He calls me by name. That only Ralph can say that. I can't do that for the guys that I sponsor as much as I want to. I can't do it for them. So I realized that first day coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a fellow named Matt who we just saw a couple weekends ago that was at my very first meeting. I see Al was at my very first meeting. On my 20-year sobriety, there were 7 or 8 people that were at that very first meeting when I wandered in that night, still sober, that came to my 20-year AA birthday. I still see Matt. And I thought about this just the other day, just a few months ago. I thought, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and Matt stuck his hand out and said, "Welcome to AA," and helped me find a seat, and he laid the hands on me. And then they gave me this mantra that's come to be incredibly sweet and meaningful to me. And that is, my name is Kenny and I am an alcoholic. So thank you very much for having us down here to Destin.